remember a couple of years ago, I got involved in a project of something that I had never attempted before, and that was the building of a 6-foot fence around the backyard of the house in which we lived. And admittedly, I had some points of frustration at the time in trying to do it and trying to get it straight and keep it on my property and not on the neighbor's property and all of these other things. And I wasn't able to do it all at once, so the work spread out over a period of several weeks. When it was finished, I did something that the neighbors, if the fence hadn't been there, they probably would have thought I was a little weird for doing. But I took a lawn chair out in the backyard and faced it up against the fence, and I sat there for half an hour or more and looked at my fence. And I thought, he did a pretty good job, really, when you look at it and you think about it. That was all right. I was pleased with what I had done. It's the thing that happens periodically, my time, and maybe yours too, particularly if you're a father, comes at Christmas time with the somewhat dubious joy of putting together all the toys that come at Christmas time. I don't know this for sure. I suspect they put them together at the factory and then take them apart again so that fathers can put them back together again. And they always put in a couple of extra parts that you don't need and take out a couple of extra parts that you do need. And then the instructions usually have 257 steps, and it becomes a little laborious. I had one set of instructions one time that one of the last instructions said, do such and such and now turn it on. And then the instructions said, you will notice it doesn't work. It said, if you will go back to step 12 and do what you were told to do there, you will find that it will work. I guess they had a lot of experience in that particular area. Well, at Christmas time, when I do that, when I put things together, the next thing after they're together is not for the children. The next is for me. I play with it. If it's a tricycle, I bang my knees, but I ride it a little bit on the driveway. And if it's a toy that flies, I take it in the yard, and I have my time with it before I turn it over to the children. That's because I enjoy the satisfaction of having done something, of having made something, of having put it together. We all thrill at the satisfaction of a job well done. And often, we pause at the completion of our handiwork and look at it and enjoy having it finished, enjoy having it work, enjoy the pleasure that comes with that type of accomplishment. And if it's something particularly significant, I mean the once or twice in a lifetime type of accomplishment, perhaps the graduation from high school or college or graduate school, or perhaps the building of a house or some really major project, we not only celebrate, even with our friends, the completion of that project, but many times we'll even mark the anniversary of the completion of that project years and years into the future. Well, that's good. That's normal. That's great. Maybe that helps us get at least a little bit of a glimpse of the type of experience that God had in the completion of his creative handiwork, his masterpieces. Genesis chapter 1, we've spent the last several weeks studying it, tells the story of creation. But by rights, the opening verses of Genesis chapter 2, I think, ought to be included as part of Genesis chapter 1. You know that the verses, or versification of the Bible, is a relatively recent thing. Not recent like in the 20th century, but I think it was back in about the 13 or 1400s that verse numbers were assigned to the Bible. And chapter division. Some of them are rather strange. I recall someone, I hope facetiously, telling the story of a person taking a Bible and going through and making the verse and chapter divisions, had a Bible in one hand and a pen in the other and marked them and was riding a horse at the time. And every time the horse went up and down, that was another verse, and the horse periodically stumbled, and that was differences between the chapters, and the rider periodically fell off, and that was the difference between the books. And one time the horse died and he had to get a new horse, and that was the Old Testament, the New Testament. Well, sometimes it seems like that. And the first three verses of Genesis chapter 2 really belong in Genesis chapter 1 because they are the epilogue, the final aspect, the last paragraph in the telling of the Genesis 1 story. There the author of Genesis writes, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. So God blessed the seventh day, and he hallowed it, because on it God rested from all his work which he had done in creation. You see, when God stopped creating, he set aside a special day of commemoration, that seventh day, the day after the completion of the 6 days of creative genius and skill. This morning, I'd like you to consider with me both the interpretation and understanding of what these three verses have to say in their original teaching, but also to go beyond that as far as their implications for us in 1977 are concerned. So I'd like you to focus with me on a couple of divine actions which came from this day after creation that's recorded in Genesis 2, 1 through 3. The first action, which leads the way to the second. The first is that God claimed this special day for himself. And he did it for a number of reasons. He claimed this day for himself simply because he was finished. If you have different translations of the Bible, and I recognize that probably you do, you'll see that there are different words for finished and completed and ended that appear in different translations in verses 1 and 2. Actually, the Hebrew word is the same throughout. All of God's creative genius over an undefined period of time was over. He had completed what he had set out to do. There was simply nothing more for the completion of his scheme. What had once been simply in the mind of God was now in reality, in actual physical appearance. There would never again be a need for God to create, to take nothing and to make something. He had finished what he had set out to do. There was nothing incomplete about his masterpiece. That's why centuries later, King Solomon, the wise sage of the Old Testament, could say in Ecclesiastes 1:9, there is nothing new under the sun. Or as Solomon also wrote in Ecclesiastes 3:14, I know that whatsoever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. To be sure, that's not saying that there aren't inventions. There aren't new fantastic things. We live in a generation which has seen absolutely amazing accomplishments. It would seem to be new that mankind has bridged the gap from Earth to the moon, and that men have walked on the moon. But the point that the Bible makes, and the point that comes out of Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3, is that everything that was later to come had its seeds and its base in what originally was accomplished by God. So that in that sense, there really is nothing new that has ever happened since then. God had it all there at the very beginning. The word that is used here, that he rested or that he completed his work, is a Hebrew word which is pronounced something like Shabbat. The word is spelled in English, an English equivalent, S-H-A-B-B-A-T-H. And we anglicize it by saying Shabbat. Or we drop out the first H and it comes out to be the familiar word in the rest of the Bible, Sabbath. Actually, in its verb form, it's translated here, rested. But that's not to say that we ought to get the wrong picture of what happened. I think some people read the book of Genesis and sort of get the idea that God was tired out. He was fatigued. He was beat from this huge amount of activity that he had done, and he had to sleep in on the next day, on Saturday morning. He had to rest and catch up and sort of regenerate and get going. Well, to be sure, that's not what is intended by Genesis chapter 2. Rather, it's saying that God simply stopped. The word means to desist, to cease. He was done. It isn't that he was tired. We're told in Psalm 121 that the God of Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. That's not one of God's characteristics. That's not what he does. He merely was finished. And because he was finished, he then claimed the next day after that completion as a special day for himself. Mind you, not for his creatures, but for himself. There's a second reason why he claimed that day, and that's because he was satisfied. You recall from our studies in the last couple of weeks, that God had said repeatedly at the end of each of the days that what he did and what he saw was good. And then at the conclusion of that sixth day on which he created human life, he said that what he saw, what he had done, was very good. God was pleased. He was satisfied with his creation. On the seventh day, he simply sat back, figuratively, to enjoy his masterpiece. In a sense, he just wanted to look at what he had done, to appreciate it, to like it, to enjoy it, to bask in that sense of satisfaction that we, in a smaller sense, experience when we complete something that has been a major project for us. God's pause, his end to creative activity, is really a further indication of the marvel of his creation. Because unlike our inventions, God's marvelous invention of the world had in it all that was necessary for its continuation. In other words, if we make something, make a car or a house, it's necessary for us to have continued upkeep and maintenance in order to maintain what we put together. That wasn't true as far as God was concerned. Not that he didn't intend to have a continuing interest. You realize that there is a view and approach to religion that is that of the deist. In fact, some people that claim that the forefathers of our country, the early founders of our country, were Christians in the sense that we would define biblical evangelical Christianity today would be very, very surprised to find out that most of the early founders of our country were in fact deists. And one of their beliefs is that God sort of finished up and then he left the world to go on by itself, a far cry from biblical Christianity. God hadn't forgotten it, but God had built into the system the continuation of the system so that God could enjoy what he had done without having to continue to create. Perhaps more important to us is a third reason why God set aside this seventh day as a special day. And that's because simply God wanted to do it. God wanted to set it apart. It was his choice for himself. God expressed his great satisfaction by declaring his special favor and sanctification of this day. You'll notice that Genesis chapter 2 says in verse 3 that God blessed the seventh day and he hallowed it. The word bless, you recall from last week, means to pour out God's beneficial favor. So God, in a special way, put his favor on that Sabbath day, that seventh day of ceasing activity. God placed his favor, his powerful favor, on that day in a way that was unique and distinctive from any of the other 6 days. Not that he didn't bless them all, but this one especially blessed. Beyond that, he hallowed it, or sanctified it. The word sanctify means to set apart, to make different, to distinguish from the rest. And so God singled out that seventh day as a day to receive his special blessing, and a day that is to be considered different from all the rest. There are several important points which we need to acknowledge at this point. One is that as much as many people would like to find the beginning of the Sabbath day as taught in Hebrew law throughout the rest of the Old Testament in Genesis chapter 2, it's really not there. It's reading something back in to assume that at this point, all of the things are basically incipient there in Genesis 2 for what's to come later on. The Sabbath day doesn't appear in these verses. It nowhere says that a Sabbath day is to be kept as a day of worship or a day of lack of work. The important point here, at least, is that this was God's day. I imagine that for Adam and Eve, that seventh day was really no different than any of the others. They did not have work in the sense that we think of work now that needs rest from fatigue, so they didn't need it for that purpose. They didn't have a lack of fellowship or communion with God on the 6 days that needed to be made up for on the seventh day, so they didn't need a special day of worship. At this point, it was simply God's day. We might roughly make a comparison to February 12th, the day that Abraham Lincoln was born. Now, when he was born, that was a big day for his mother and for his family, but who in the rest of the United States cared? Who had ever even heard of Abraham Lincoln? At that point, it didn't matter. But later on, it had a new significance until it has become, in modern times, a day of national celebration, a national holiday. That's because a significance was added later on to what originally was the occurrence. So it was with the Sabbath day. The Jews added on, under God's direction, to what originally was simply the day of God's celebration of what he had done in creation. It was his special day. I'm fascinated by all of the verifications of biblical truth that come from things outside of the Bible. And I must insert here one that I think is particularly neat. That is that when we look at our calendar, we see that the 365 or so days of the year are based upon the earth going around the sun. So we have a solar calendar. And that's not something that we have too much to do with. If we change the year to be 1,000 days, we're going to be obviously in trouble. The seasons won't work out. Things won't fit together. Likewise with months. Months are based upon the moon going around the earth. And so we have a lunar month. It's a rather obvious thing that comes out of nature. Likewise with the length of days, 24 hours. I mean, it's based upon the fact of the rotation of the earth on its axis. All of those are natural phenomena. But what's the basis for a week? I mean, why 7 days? Why not, if we have a 28 or 30-day month, why not have 7 weeks of 4 days? Or why not have some other combination? Why 7 days? It's interesting that archaeologists and historians have gone back and found, even in the earliest days of history in cultures all over the world, that the 7-day week was common. Long before the birth of Jesus Christ, a 7-day week was observed by the Chinese, by the Hindus, by the Egyptians, by the Jews, by the Chaldeans, by the Persians, and even by the Peruvians all the way over in the New World in the Western Hemisphere, all observing a 7-day week. Fascinating. Not because of the earth or the moon or the sun, not because of some natural phenomenon, but because we all come from that same source in Adam and Eve, who learned the lesson of creation, that God had created the world in 6 days and had a 7th day markedly his own, the day of celebration and satisfaction with what he had created. Well, the more important action, at least as far as we are personally concerned, is not that God set aside this day for himself, but that God, in his second action, gave his very special day to us. He gave it away, a gift for us to enjoy. And again, there are several reasons why God did this, the first of which obviously has to be because of our need. God gave us a gift to meet our need. You see, when sin entered the world, it caused havoc. Change creation had ramifications that even to this day we don't fully realize. Sin totally altered just about every possible area of God's creation. That meant then that labor with fatigue, with drudgery, with discomfort became a normal and ordinary part of human existence, became a burden for our race to bear. And God began to recognize and realize how critically important it was to fill in two gaps. One was a need for humans to have rest, and the second was a need for humans to have communion and fellowship with God. And so God gave away his special day to fill that need, seeing that on that day his creatures would have rest, and on that day, distinctive from all others, his creatures would have special communion and fellowship with God. Since the creation, the progress went on, and that day was given, but that day has been greatly misunderstood. Other than the difficulties that arose in Jesus' teaching concerning his claim to messiahship, probably the New Testament Gospels would indicate that Jesus was most criticized and most misunderstood for his teaching on the Sabbath day. He was maligned, he was contradicted, He was argued with, and he introduced what to the Jews of that day was a revolutionary theology. When, as recorded in Mark 2:27, Jesus said, "The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath." That simply wasn't the way those Jews saw it. In other words, God in his wisdom and God in his generous love had seen the needs of mankind and had graciously, generously given to mankind his very special, his very blessed day to meet our need. I hope that's understood. I think there's sometimes a tendency to resent, to almost cringe at a Sabbath day concept. How far from biblical teaching and truth. God never intended his Sabbath principle, his Sabbath day, to be a burden. He intended it to be a blessing. And we pathetically miss God's point when we think it a burden, when it's really a blessing. I read some time ago about mining in Pennsylvania, a number of years back, where the practice was to use mules in the mines deep underground. A visitor to the countryside mining area of Pennsylvania happened to be driving along on one Sunday and saw an unusually large number of mules out grazing in a pasture. And he asked his host that he was staying with why that was. The host explained that for some time there had been the practice of keeping those mules working, or at least keeping them in the mine 7 days a week. But they discovered that if they kept them down there for 7 days, that eventually the mules would go blind. And so they inaugurated the practice of bringing them out 1 day out of seven so that they would protect their health and preserve them from blindness. That type of humane treatment is paralleled in God's humanitarian concern for us as creatures, when he has very carefully given 1 day in seven, the day that was particularly his own, to us, so that we won't go blind, so that our physical needs won't be missed. There are so many parallels to ordinary experience where needs have gone unmet simply because people have ignored God's Sabbath principle. Again and again, you and I meet, or we experience ourselves, the difficulties that come with people who are working a 7 day week. They do it to get ahead, they do it to make money, they do it often for excellent motives, to provide for family, to meet needs, to pay bills, to preserve health. But how many times have we, in our own experience, viewed the lives of those who, because of that type of drudgery, that type of routine, have found that the goals were elusive, that the dreams were never realized, that in fact, those things that were sought escaped, and so the fortune was lost and the family sometime was destroyed and the health was crushed simply because those principles were ignored. God knew those needs, so he gave us his day. Another reason is simply his goodness. He gave us his own very special day because of his goodness to us. He provided this Sabbath principle. And I'm concerned that we recognize that the Sabbath principle is more important than any Old Testament law concerning Sabbath day. The Sabbath principle is that man needs 1 day out of seven for a special rest and communion with God. God recognized that need, and he stepped in to do something about it, to meet both the physical and the spiritual needs. To be sure, throughout the centuries, that principle has been differently applied, has been differently interpreted, has been differently understood, but it has always been there. And if we ignore the Sabbath principle, then we are disinheriting ourselves from one of God's greatest, most tangible gifts to us. Now, immediately, if you're as I am, questions arise concerning, well, what was God trying to do then in the Old Testament? What was that all about? Jews in the Old Testament and some Jews who seek to live by the Old Testament law today find that law very strict and very restrictive. There were limits on how far a Jew could even walk on a Sabbath day, so a Sabbath day's journey was defined. The Old Testament law prohibited making fires on a Sabbath day, preparing meals. And I've talked with Orthodox Jews who, in the 20th century, will not use an electric razor on a Saturday because that's making a fire, won't turn on a light switch on a Sabbath day between sundown Friday and sundown Saturday because that's making a fire in the light bulb, won't drive an automobile, won't do many of these things simply because that was the Old Testament law. You remember that during those wilderness wanderings, the Jews were to pick up enough manna for food for only one day, and if they get 2 days' worth, the manna would spoil, except the manna that they would collect on Friday, and there they could pick a double amount, and that would get them through the weekend over until Sunday, because God wanted no labor, no work on that seventh day, that Sabbath day. In fact, it went so far that the law specifies in Exodus chapter 31 that someone who breaks the Sabbath law, works on the Sabbath day, was guilty of a capital crime, was killed. Now, how do we respond to that? We say, wow, that's God's really good. I mean, don't you appreciate that? He gives you a gift, and if you don't take it, he kills you for it. That doesn't seem like a very nice approach. Isn't God a little unfair in that perspective? Perhaps it may seem that way, but I think that we need to understand how important God recognized it to be that this principle be lived out in ordinary human life. If you follow what's been happening in the legislature here in Minnesota recently, you're aware of a law that was recently rescinded, a law that still is on the books in many, many states, and some states are putting it in while other states are taking it out, and that relates to the wearing of motorcycle helmets and the question of whether or not that ought to be required. But in many states today, it's required that someone riding a motorcycle wear a helmet. Now, why does the state legislature pass that type of law? It's not to help the helmet manufacturing industry. It's not to allow policemen to take out their vengeance against bareheaded motorcyclists. It's so that the person can be protected. Now, admittedly, there are people that have argued and said it's wrong and it's an infringement of constitutional rights and I don't want to do it. But the law in many states still stands that for the person's protection, the law has been established and there is a penalty for breaking that law. During the Old Testament economy of God's dealing with mankind, God strictly enforced the Sabbath principle as a law. But we live in a new era, a new economy, a new time. We live not under the old covenant, but under the new covenant. So we don't have Sabbath day law. We have Sabbath day grace. And that's very, very different. For there was an amazing transformation that came with the New Testament. No longer were people forced to conform by law. Instead, Christians were given the Holy Spirit to motivate us from the inside rather than laws to legislate us from the outside. Do you know that Jesus, in his earthly teaching, that which we have record of, reiterated and reaffirmed nine of the Ten Commandments? So in one form or another, Jesus reinforced or put his authority behind nine of them. There's one exception, and that's the fourth commandment. And Jesus never stood behind nor repeated or had teaching concerning the enforcement of the fourth commandment. Do you remember your memorization of the Ten Commandments? The fourth being, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Jesus was no longer insisting upon any type of legalistic legislation of the keeping of the Sabbath law. He knew that something better was coming to replace the Sabbath law. The Saturday Sabbath observance of Jews had been deeply entrenched in the Judeo-culture. But when the Council of Jerusalem met, it's recorded in the 15th chapter of Acts, and when they decided what were the areas of Jewish life that were to be enforced in Gentile Christians, even though they were Jews who had lived with a strict observance of the Sabbath day, that Saturday Sabbath, they omitted it, because they recognized that Jesus' teaching excluded any legal enforcement of the Sabbath day. For they also recognized that something new and something exciting was happening. Something wonderfully different. A spiritual phenomenon. Christians no longer were looking back to creation as the great event. Christians were more concerned now with the completion of their redemption than with the completion of creation. And so they switched their day of rest and worship and celebration from Saturday, the day that marked God's rest and celebration of creation, to Sunday, the day that marked the completion of their salvation through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the grave. Suddenly they had a new day. The principle hadn't changed. It was still a day God had given. It was still the Sabbath principle. But it was marking the resurrection of Jesus Christ, Easter. So that we as Christians today are celebrating Easter every Sunday, every time that we gather together. There was then in the Christians the outpouring and the outliving of the Holy Spirit. So it was no longer necessary to require a celebration of the Sabbath. Christians wanted to do it. They wanted to gather in the name of Jesus Christ. They were thrilled. They were pleased. They were excited. That turned them on. That's what they wanted. Joyfully, triumphantly, even in the earliest days of the church, they began to apply the Sabbath principle to the first day of the week, the day Sunday. And they called it the Lord's Day because of their love for the Lord, because of their celebration of their salvation. They were thrilled with God's ancient gift for a weekly opportunity to set aside a day of rest and celebration of God's love. How do we bring all that together into 1977, into our lives? How do we as parents communicate it to our children? How do we as businessmen, as homemakers, how do we put these things into ordinary practice? It's critically important that we do. Ought we to be legalistically bound to a burdensome day of strict rules, unpleasant activity? By no means. But let me share with you a few concrete suggestions, at least for your prayerful consideration and discussion. One is that you recognize that God has given you one day that is to be used because it is needed to be a day of rest and spiritual refreshment. Please, don't be so foolish as to squander such a tangible and important gift. Now let me just tie into what I think is a very concrete example of this. In the last week or two, I've been doing some studying on the life of Wooddale Church through the years, and about a week or so ago, I read through 132 pages that are about that big of a computer profile of the church that probably many of you, most of you perhaps, participated in September of 1972. And there were just scores and scores of questions that were asked, and the computer analyzes it on the basis of how many people in each age category answered in each way, and how many men and how many women, and basis of education, and how much church they attend. And all, it's just broken down, every question, all different types of directions. One of those questions had to do with the practice of devotions, or a family altar, a quiet time, both individually and as a family, corporately together. I was interested to note a number of things. One is, I think that if Wooddale were compared to other churches, we would be pleased to see that the percentage is relatively high for those that have that type of daily or at least weekly spiritual exercise. But one thing that interested me, while there wasn't a straight curve on it, if it were being graphed, there were strong indications that the highest percentage of those who had a daily discipline of Bible study and prayer were those who were the oldest people. Now, I suppose there are a number of reasons for that. One may be that perhaps those of us who are from younger families have simply not gained the spiritual maturity to have that type of discipline. And perhaps that comes with a longer experience, a lifetime of walking with the Lord. I think that's a part of it, and probably an important part of it. But it also needs to be tied in there. We need also to recognize that many families in their earlier years with younger children and jobs, and sometimes with several part-time jobs and both husband and wife working and all of the things that are going along, time is so bound up that many times, admittedly, we get our priorities out of line. And so, even though we would like to have daily times of prayer and Bible study, we don't. Doesn't it then become that much more important that we have that day, a day that may even come at a price, but one day in seven when we get away from all of that other routine and all of those other pressures, when we have a day of rest and we have a day of communion and fellowship with God? If you find that your schedule is so busy that you don't have a set-aside time for God every day, not only ought that practice be sought, but then it becomes that much more important to take in every other opportunity for spiritual life. That means that it is more important for the person who does not have spiritual output during the week to attend not only a Sunday morning church service, but Sunday evening and a Sunday school class as well. It becomes critically important that that seventh day be used in a way that makes a difference in life. Well, again, there are so many applications that can be made of this seventh day principle. For most people, I assume that that one day in seven for rest and for worship and for spiritual growth should be Sunday. But there are some of us, who have trouble taking Sundays off. I've thought about it, but how do you pull that off if many of your major responsibilities are on Sunday? And there are probably a number of people, it may be you, there may be people who can't be here today simply because their work assignment precludes it. Well, then there still has to be the principle. The principle of a day for rest and a day for God. Beyond that, Sunday being that day under most normal circumstances, the Sabbath day principle, as utilized by Christians, would say that we need to be constantly reminding ourselves every Sunday morning, if not every day of the week, that this day is the marking of the anniversary of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. For every Christian, every Sunday should be a day of celebration. The one day in seven ought to be different from all the rest. Now, admittedly, how you do that becomes a matter between you and God. Let me say that it ought to be a day of enjoyment. The one day in seven that marks your Sabbath principle utilization ought to be a day that you thoroughly enjoy. You look forward to all the rest of the week. You plan it that way. It's not a dull day. It's an exciting day. It's an important day. It ought also to be a day of rest and relaxation. Rest for some may be different than rest for others. Relaxation for one is different than relaxation for another. But it ought to be very different from the other 6 days of labor. It's interesting, and I won't tackle the theology of this, but it's interesting that we in our culture, being on a 5-day work week, thinking about going to a 4-day work week, that the Bible specifically says that we're to work 6 days and then rest on a seventh day. You worry about that. I can't figure that one out. It also, this seventh day, also ought to be a day of spiritual communion with God. A man who I greatly admire said something one day to me just in passing, and he probably wouldn't remember he said it, but it left a lasting impression on me. A man of God who said in the busyness of his daily routine he had not had enough time for prayer. And he said, you know, I must take a day, and I must catch up on my prayer. That was good. That was a recognition of where he was at. That seventh day ought to have some time set aside in it for catching up, perhaps, on the spiritual communion with God that we've missed out during the other days of the week. Let me have your imagination for just a second. Imagine a man in a ghetto, a poor man, who suddenly receives word that he has received a great inheritance. And now he's a wealthy man, but he cannot have the substance of that inheritance. You know the way some wills are worked out. They have all types of, like the lady in Texas who insists that she be buried in her Ferrari, if you've been following that in the newspaper. People put all kinds of contingencies in. But imagine with me a man in a ghetto who suddenly discovers that he has become the beneficiary of a huge fortune, millions of dollars. But he can't get all of it for, say, 10 years. However, on one day out of each week, he can have the benefits of his fortune. And so the executors of the estate, the functionaries of the court, see that it works out that way. So for 6 days, he lives in poverty. In 6 days, he works very hard. On 6 days, he's hungry and tired, and he's a pauper. But on one day, he becomes a prince. And one day he has all the benefits of the fortune that only temporarily is his, but that sometime will be totally his. And so through the drudgery of week after week with those 6 days, he looks forward to the seventh day, because that seventh day is a promise of all the fortune that will someday be his own. Maybe that's a crude example, a crude parallel of what God has given us in that seventh day. Through being tired, through having heavy responsibilities, through working hard, through what may be humdrum, God has given us a day that was his that has become ours. And he has asked that we use that day for our benefit, and that we recognize that day to be a promise of many days in eternity of future, when we shall be then the recipients of all of God's blessing, and we'll have an eternity of days of rest and celebration, communion with God. What glorious days those will be. I encourage you, don't just forget it. Don't just read these verses and let it go. If your lifestyle needs to be changed, do it. God's giving you a gift. Take the gift and put it in your schedule and receive God's good blessings. Let's stand and we'll pray as we're dismissed.